Hello, my name is Kate, and I am a graduate student at the Massachusetts College Pharmacy of Health Sciences in Boston. The CDC reports that 130 Americans die every day from an opioid-related overdose, and over 2 million Americans have been diagnosed with an opioid use disorder. I am working on a project alongside other students to bring attention to the work being done by individuals and organizations who are on the front line of the opioid epidemic. Our goal in this project is to shed light on the pivotal attempts to improve the health of our communities and the lives of those impacted. Welcome, Michael. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Would you mind sharing a bit about your background?
I've been teaching here at MCP for a little over 20 years now, and I've worked in this job as both an inpatient psychiatric pharmacist and in the outpatient behavioral health clinic over at the VA, and I also do work with Medicaid programs and other insurance programs.
Mm-hmm. What are you currently working on?
In terms of research?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. We are working on a project with Medicaid right now to diminish the co-occurring use of benzodiazepines and opiates in that population. And we're trying to institute policy to help clinicians figure out a safer way to taper down one or the other.
Mm-hmm. What policy modifications are you hoping to see come into play here?
I'd like to see much fewer persons on benzodiazepines and more on the antidepressant treatments for depression, for anxiety, because the benzodiazepines and the opiates together are such a risk in terms of overdose-related death that they shouldn't be on it in the first place, because antidepressants are considered the mainline treatment for anxiety disorders. Many of these patients aren't even on an antidepressant at all, never mind an antidepressant low dose plus a benzo every day. There's no guidelines to suggest that that's a good idea unless it's an incredibly treatment-refractory patient. And so our goal is hopefully to get persons on a more standardized, evidence-based protocol for their anxiety, which reduce their risk if they're also using an opiate for pain.
Mm-hmm. So what would the status of the opioid epidemic in New Bedford be like?
Pretty bad. Yeah, we St. Luke's Hospital, which is where I'm based for my consult service, we have a fair amount of persons coming in for either overdose or detox. In our emergency department, then we obviously bring them up to the ICU if necessary. So I'd say we're probably one of those hotspots.
Mm-hmm. Yep. How has that impacted your work as a psychiatric clinical pharmacist?
I've been much more involved with policies in regards to opiate withdrawal protocols within the hospital, alcohol withdrawal protocols in the hospital. And recently we did a quality assurance measure to see how many patients were discharging on benzos and opiates together. And we found that we could probably do a little bit better job at maybe reducing the benzo use upon discharge. You know, we only have the patients for a few days because, you know, it's an inpatient hospital. But if we can drop their benzo use by maybe 20% upon discharge, hopefully producing some harm reduction in that population.
Mm-hmm. What other harm reduction strategies would you like to see come into play?
I'd like to see that we don't have to fix a problem. I like to see that the problem never started in the first place. Mm-hmm. That's what I'd like.
Why are you seeing that benzodiazepines are being so prominently prescribed?
It's hard to tell, because for over 20 years, the guidelines have said use the antidepressants as your maintenance treatment for anxiety disorders. And according to one study that came out a couple years ago, they actually showed that prescriptions for benzodiazepines have gone up, and gone up by 200%. In patients who are also on an opiate with it. And that's something that was published just 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to understand why clinicians are feeling so comfortable with benzodiazepines, despite the fact that for 20 years we've known that that's not the way to treat anxiety, and for 50 years we've known that the combination with an opiate is a harmful event.
Mm-hmm. Just continuing education, like opinions. We can just cut out my voice. I was trying to keep my voice in.
Yeah, I realized, like, we can just kind of talk. Yeah,
just cut it out. When we were doing it over the phone, it was the same. But I was thinking about, like, you know, you should repeat the question after so it's not my voice, but what's, like, your opinion on continuing education credits for MDs? And, would that be a solution or at least an intervention, you know, for reducing benzo prescribing, the combination of the two, updating on guidelines, making sure prescribers are aware?
Okay. What continuing education policies and protocols would you like to see in place for MDs, and how do you think that we could use that to combat sort of overprescribing with benzodiazepines?
Yeah, I've done a few already in the last few years to different the different MD NP groups, and they seem successful based on the evaluation, but we haven't measured anything to see if locally it actually changed prescribing habits.
Gotcha. And would you say that you've seen similar trends in benzodiazepine overprescribing as you have in opioid overprescribing?
I would say that you could see equal overprescribing because there's a fair amount of patients who don't require either, you know, long term. The idea that benzodiazepines have an alternative, and actually an alternative that's preferred by the expert opinions of how do you treat anxiety disorders, whereas opiates, sometimes you do get stuck with a pain is so severe, you have to give an opiate. So the overprescribing would occur with both drug classes. The what would be inappropriate in one drug class may be that it's the wrong drug altogether, versus with the opiates, it could be that they need an opiate, but maybe we're not prescribing it or monitoring it appropriately.
Can you speak to sort of medication-assisted treatment as another option instead of... that's a bad question. How am I trying to phrase this?
Are you going
to
talk about like maintaining people on medication-assisted treatment, or you can just start with the nature of addiction? The brain chemistry part of it.
Okay. Would you care to speak about the nature of addiction as a chronic brain disease?
The data is pretty clear that there's a genetic risk associated with it. There are actually changes in the brain of people who use drugs chronically, and perhaps baseline differences. It's hard to tease that out because they do a randomized trial and say, well, I want you to become addicted and you not, and let's see what happens to your brain. That's difficult to do. But when you look at these studies, these epidemiological studies, there's clear data to say that it's not just a lifestyle choice or just an environmental hazard. It's clearly there's something different about those person's brains. I mean, I work with these patients. They all hate being a drug user, having a substance use disorder. Not one person has ever said, I love having a substance use disorder. They all hate it. And they have such difficulty stopping that that's why they keep going back into the hospital. Mm.
That's something that we've certainly tried to work on, is decreasing the stigma surrounding substance use disorder and sort of looking at it more from a clinical standpoint as opposed to a personal failure, basically.
Yeah. Can you talk more about the populations you work with and like the patients?
So I do spend a day a week with an inpatient psych hospital where I actually do a med group with the dual diagnosis unit. And then some of the other adult units also have substance use comorbid, but it all depends on what kind of brought you into the hospital, depending on what unit you go on to. And so working with those patients in that kind of setting, there's clear understanding that their illness, their substance use kills them. They've all known people who have killed themselves, overdoses or just due to depression from the substance use disorder. So every one of these patients know this harm. And when you talk to them, you say, well, why are you doing it? I can't stop. I would love to stop. My cousin just died 3 weeks ago. Those kind of comments. The most amazing comment I would find is that they know someone who died recently from an overdose. And I said, so what'd you do with that dealer? Did you call the cops on the dealer or do something more aggressive towards the dealer? Because basically he killed your cousin. And they go, no, I called him up and asked him, I wanted some of his stuff because it was the most potent. And I said, that's why it's an illness, isn't it? And they go, yeah, it's crazy. So all the patients know how backwards it is in terms of their health care. So that's one of the things that is nice to hear them say that, now to help them get into that lifestyle where they don't have to use that. There are other forms of, lifestyle things that we can help them with. Mm-hmm. But we're really working on the nerves in the brain saying this is a good idea. Right. Even though other nerves of the brain are literally telling them this is a bad idea.
Right.
And they just can't stop. Because if they could, they would.
Could you speak about the dual diagnosis programs that you're working on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's substance use disorder plus another psychiatric illness. And I work with both patients coming into the hospital saying for a psychotic break who may also be using substances, or persons who come in through the emergency department, they overdose, and then they're sent to the psychiatric hospital. And they may have depression or anxiety disorders. Bipolar is a very common one, but their primary reason for getting admitted was due to the substance use. So it gets teased out that way. And so working with them, you always have to deal with the baseline issues of, if you have bipolar, not treating someone's mania, they're going to relapse because the mania produces an impulsiveness, a grandiosity where you think you can control the drugs. And so they're going to relapse. So you have to treat their bipolar and at the same time have to work on their substance use disorder perspective.
That sounds like it presents some unique challenges.
It is. It's hard. And it's easy for us as clinicians to look at the patient and say, okay, here's what's going on. But to implement a treatment plan that the patient can buy into, and they're not fighting it. Mm-hmm. It's just their brain is saying it's a bad idea. Mm-hmm. So it's hard.
What aspects of treatment plans have you found most effective?
I would say the style of rapport or the style of interaction you have with the patient. Over-exaggerating, or having a personal opinion, that's just, it's ridiculousness. The idea that a patient can see right through it, because they're living it, they know what dose is this, and they know what drugs are there. Incredibly self-trained chemist. Incredibly good self-trained chemist. So the idea of just saying, here's the straight facts, and here's what you know what it's done to your life, here's what it did to your cousin's life, all the, you know, using examples that they can see, they all will agree. So it's the idea of being non-judgmental, but also the idea of saying, you know, I'm just going to give you the straight facts, and I'm going to help you get to a healthier lifestyle, but I know it's going to be hard for you, and I ain't going to get mad when you can't do it, because if you could do it, you wouldn't have needed me in the first place. And so it's that kind of straight shooting, no bullshitting, but the idea that if you take it a different kind of approach, meaning, oh, well, I don't want to bring it up, or, you know, you got to be abstinent starting tomorrow, no, I'm not working on anybody. They'll just turn around and walk out. So you have to work with them where they are. It's no different, really, than diabetes. People don't fix their diet on day one when they have diabetes. They slowly stop eating donuts. And they still relapse to donuts. But we don't yell at them for that as much as we might yell at someone who relapses to a substance use. So it's in that same realm in my brain, anyway, of how I treat it.
Gotcha. Especially with the Medicare population, what kind of barriers are you seeing getting people access to treatment and resources?
I don't think there's actually a barrier that's unique to Medicare or Medicaid. I think it's the fact that there's just not a lot of resources available. So whether you've got Blue Cross or not, a lot of the resources aren't wonderful in their treatments, meaning that they're doing the best they can, but, you know, are they staffed appropriately? Are the persons that they have there, are they like the best in their field, or are they persons who look for a job and they mean well, but they're not really well-versed or well-trained? And so I find that the substance use population sometimes doesn't get the best of the best. Sometimes, I mean, there are some. Dr. John Renner, he's fantastic, works out of Boston Medical Center and BU Medical School. He's great. And you got others that you're like, maybe we should do a little bit more training with you, kind of thing. So I get a little discouraged sometimes looking at who works with the substance use population sometimes. So I wish we could have more training.
That was actually my next question, is as an educator, how do you feel that students, especially graduating students, are trained and prepared for a healthcare crisis like this?
Yeah, it's better in the last 5 years, partly because of what Frank's been doing, for sure, because, you know, I work with students and I have my little lectures, but after an hour, 3 hours, whatever time they give me to give the lecture, that's kind of done. And unless the person comes on rotation with me, we're not going to get into the weeds that we do as an intern. So I only have a small impact based on just the way the system is designed. It would be nice if maybe we had a part of a lab where it was dedicated to how do you interact with someone who has a substance use disorder, knowing that the persons with substance use disorder may actually say things differently on purpose, because their brain is saying, well, over-exaggerate a little bit. Just, you don't want to get high today, but get a little extra dose in case you want to get high this weekend. I mean, that's very rational thinking if the goal is to live that kind of lifestyle. And so working with that kind of population takes a unique set of interviewing skills and experience, in my opinion. You can't just say, oh, I know all about how to treat pain with opiates and then not know how to talk to someone who actually may be very good at manipulating conversations so that you give them more opiate. Because they do it for survival. They're fantastic at it. So, but that probably would be better if we could train persons on the interview process and the data. And lab collection, because lab collection is based on, you know, the PDMP and urine screens and how to ask a question a certain way, maybe multiple times within a session, those type of things. Getting family to provide information for you. You got to do that. You can't just rely on the patient saying, yes, my pain's a 3. Please increase my Percocet. I don't know, you were in the waiting room and you were actually showing someone how to do a river dance right before I brought you into the office. Now you're wincing and saying you're in a lot of pain. Those kind of techniques are important.
It sounds like we have a long way to go in terms of humanizing this whole process and getting people the treatment they need.
I think so. What would be nice is if we had a cap that measured true, what is the person experiencing from a pain number that can be like a blood pressure kind of thing, where the number is kind of within a ballpark that no one can manipulate, because, as you know, with pain, what's your pain? It's a 3. Well, we could be having both a 3. And there would be different levels of pain, technically, from a neurologic perspective. It could be different thresholds that we can handle, that we would both call a 3. No one's lying. No one's being malicious about it. So to standardize, what's a 3, what's a 7, and to get rid of all this, well, I might be seeing a 7 because I have another agenda in mind. That'd be nice. Some kind of EEG cap that measures the pain waves in a certain part of the brain. That would just be another way to do it.
Yeah, that's definitely
maybe
one of the
you
flaws.
Guys will invent it. That'd be cool.
Yeah,
really. And then I can say, I know them.
So there's some talk about questioning whether we should be assessing pain on an initial visit, sort of the pain as the fifth vital sign. What are your perceptions on that?
Well, I'm old enough where that came into play. So I was there before they did it, and then kind of when I started, we started doing it and saying, oh my God, we're not assessing pain well enough. And now to say, are we not assessing it? Well, I'd have to say we have to assess pain, because pain affects motivation. It can affect mood from a psychiatric perspective. The more depressed you are, the more sensitive you are to pain. And the more in pain you are, that you score positive for depression, despite the fact it's really secondary to your pain. Treat the person's pain, their depression scores go way down. So this idea that we can't ignore it as a symptom, but how aggressive do we have to make someone's pain go away? I mean, just in the meeting the other day with the dual diagnosis unit, I said, what do we want to treat our pain scores to? And someone raised their hand and said, a 0. I go, so you walk around 0, and then you step on a nail, and you don't know it, and you lose your foot because you didn't know you had a nail in your foot. You know, we want to treat to 3. Just educating the patient on that we want you to have a little pain, because we all walk around with a little pain. It's a marker to say, oh, you've injured yourself. Pay attention to the fact that you whacked your hand on the door, something like that. And so that kind of education and stuff could be helpful for the persons who are not manipulating the conversation. And I don't think we do that well enough.
Mm-hmm. What strategies or what would you recommend for future practitioners who want to get involved but don't really know how to go about that?
Get involved in the pain management or the substance use management?
Let's do substance use management first.
My advice would be to really work in a substance use clinic and assume that you're going to be manipulated for a good 2 to 5 years. Because they're just so good. It's a survival skill for them. So they're just really good at it. And it's not, like I said, it's not a malicious thing. It's taking it from a non-judgmental perspective that these persons are going to say things, and it's our job to figure out, is it really a 7 or is it more of a 5? And that other 2 is because they have a substance use issue from a pain perspective. Those type of things. Or are they selling it? I mean, if someone's selling their meds, their oxycodone or something, and they're making $2,000 a month from it, and you say, well, we're going to start getting rid of your oxycodone. Basically, we said you're fired, and now you don't have a job. And it's not like you can transition to another PA or pharmacy position. I mean, you're saying, well, I was kind of selling my pills. What do I do now? I can't really put that on a resume. So there's a lot of reasons these guys freak out about the fact that we're really trying to help them in the long run. Mm-hmm. And so recognizing that there are all these other motivations on the patient side that are very frightening to them. Like I said, not a malicious type of thing, but very frightening to them, that they're going to be very aggressive at maintaining a certain lifestyle. And so that kind of skill set, that experience, I guess I should say, I think is pretty important. Mm-hmm. So I'd say 2 to 5 years of working in the clinic with a clinic that has good training, and then say, okay, I think I'm ready to go on my own, or at least be in charge and start training other people after a few years. Yeah. I think we should do that better, because I think the other stuff's easy. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you treat generalized anxiety disorder? Well, maintenance therapy with the SSRI and a benzo once a month for breakthrough. I mean, that's it. We're done. Yeah. That's how much training we know for how to treat GAD. But when it comes to the assessment, oh, what's your anxiety like? What is the side effect of Zoloft that you say you don't want to use that now? And why are you on Ativan 3 times a day? That's all that other substance use disorder side that we have to be better trained for. Mm-hmm. It's hard.
Definitely. Can we
talk about community stuff a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. So we already asked what populations. I guess I want to say, in terms of your community projects, what are you currently working on, and how has your how have your projects impacted?
So I'm in the middle of starting a new project. Carly, you were actually very helpful in that, despite the fact you weren't there. We stole a lot of your data, so thank you very much. Where we've been educating the non-prescribing practitioner. A little bit of the prescribers were there, but it was mostly meetings with persons who are the counselors or the case managers, and educating them about these types of things. How do you treat anxiety disorders? What are the pain therapies, and what are these other options, and how to monitor for those, and training them to be more aware. And the next step is then to do, in the New Bedford area, because it's such a big risk, but to do some more of the community outreach, where our expectation is that we will probably get family members who will come, you know, maybe free food, music, other types of things being there, maybe blood pressure screening, all that type of stuff, and then also have a substance use disorder area, a booth kind of thing, and have discussions with persons like that. Our belief is that, like I said, it'll be mostly family members who will come and talk to us about this stuff, and just educating them to say, here's what you want to look for, here's some of the techniques we can use, these are the names of meds that are abused, because the mother might not know anything about, this is an opiate, that's not an opiate. So educating them in those regards and helping them be more of a watchdog for the patient who happens to live in their house with them. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff. That's the next steps.
So sort of increasing awareness and advocating for those with substance use disorders.
Correct. And we're starting at the non-prescriber level, but clinicians. And then also then the family members or the patients, if they would go. I just don't imagine that a true substance user would want to go into the booth and hear the things that they already know. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. And then from there, do more CEs to the prescribers.
Gotcha. Where do you want to go from here? Would you mind talking a little bit about medication-assisted treatment and combating substance use disorder from that perspective?
Sure. There's basically three. There's the full agonist methadone, the partial agonist buprenorphine, and then the antagonist naltrexone. The data shows that buprenorphine probably is the most effective for the general population, the bell curve kind of patients. Methadone for the more serious person who has an opiate use disorder, more on the addict description side. And then naltrexone, 100% necessary for the healthcare provider who has access to these options. But by naltrexone being an antagonist, patients sometimes fall out of treatment sooner in the studies and just in real life. They fall out of treatment sooner because of the pure blockade of endorphins. Because, as you know, these drugs are not opiate drugs. They're actually endorphins. We just call it the opiate system, not realizing that it was really the endorphin system. So when you block person's endorphins, you're blocking a little bit of the pleasure that the endorphins are there in our brain in the first place. So there seems to be a little bit of dysphoria. Duration of treatment with naltrexone is a little bit less than it is with buprenorphine. So we would say that buprenorphine from a bell curve is probably the most effective. And naltrexone is a great option for certain populations where, hey, I want to keep my job as a pharmacist. Well, you can't work in a pharmacy that has oxycodone and fentanyl patches. Well, I'm on naltrexone. So therefore, that helps me not using these drugs. So that's a good area. Other patients where naltrexone is necessary, that's great too. It comes as a long-acting shot, so that's helpful for patients. But overall, buprenorphine probably is the smartest way to do it because these persons typically have a lower stimulation on that system because of their chronic use. They've just downregulated. And buprenorphine being a partial agonist helps bring them back up to what's considered a within normal limits amount of mu stimulation within their brain. And that's why buprenorphine seems to have that nice little niche for the most patients. Like if a person was low in insulin, we'd give them insulin. Well, these persons, per the biological data that we're starting to collect, look to be a little bit low in endorphins. Mm. Over time, could be the fact that they use the drugs, or maybe genetically, they just don't make as much endorphins as other people, and that's why they became opiate users in the first place. Something's going on there. So the buprenorphine seems to put them within normal limits.
Mm. What barriers have you seen patients come across when trying to access this kind of treatment?
Well, methadone clinics have a finite number of spots, so that's a problem. You have to go every day. That's a problem. So the access, that's why buprenorphine, when it came out in 2000, was the Data Act when it came out in 2000, was landmark because it said we got a population of patients who would even want treatment, and we just can't provide it because we don't have enough spots to give it to them. Never mind the fact that it can be kind of annoying for a person who's trying to get a job. Mm-hmm. Oh, I can't come in until 10 o'clock. Well, then you're fired because you're supposed to be here at 8 o'clock. Well, I have to go to the methadone clinic at 8. And then you're out of the methadone clinic or you're out of your job. And we're trying to reintegrate them in healthy lifestyles. So buprenorphine was huge in that regard. in getting them into treatment. I think there's enough prescribers for buprenorphine. I don't know of too many places where they say, I can't find a buprenorphine prescriber. Mm. My concern is that some of these, Suboxone is the brand name for it, but some of these buprenorphine prescribers, are they doing their due diligence with such a difficult population? Once again, the training about how do you screen for, you know, true needs of an opiate or true needs of a benzo versus the manipulative conversation of a benzo. And I think a lot of these treaters had good intentions, but they, after a weekend worth of training, I think the disease state's just a little over their head. Mm-hmm. And so, if anything, I don't think the number needs to go up, but those training maybe should be every 3 months for the first year, refreshers kind of stuff, or just mandate. Because, you know, you're mandated to have access to the non-pharmacologic treatments, which are a huge part of these disorders. But you don't have to demand that the person who's getting buprenorphine go to AA meetings or NA meetings or, you know, even any kind of counseling meetings. You don't have to demand that to give them their buprenorphine. You just have to say, I have access if this patient needs it. And maybe it should be demanded because that's a huge part of the treatment of this illness. Buprenorphine doesn't get rid of opiate use disorder. It's buprenorphine gets rid of some of the cravings so that now they can work on the other parts of their life so that they don't have to keep going back to opiates. So that could be better.
Can you talk a little bit more about the non-pharmacological options for people with substance use?
Yeah, well, we talked a little bit about before in terms of assessing, is there a depressive disorder there? Is there an anxiety disorder that says, hey, every time I take a Xanax, my anxiety goes down? Well, yeah, dulled your brain, but it didn't really treat your anxiety, but it did work. We're not lying. And so therefore, I'm just going to keep doing that versus how do I really treat anxiety? So what makes me anxious? Well, you know, doing a podcast makes me anxious. Well, then maybe you shouldn't be doing a lot of podcasts or going to talk and therapy or meditation. A lot of options that for mild anxiety are equally effective to meds and probably better. Mm-hmm. Meaning side effect-wise and stuff like that. And certainly exercise has been shown to have some benefit. Meditation has shown to have tremendous benefit. Cognitive behavioral therapy, tremendous benefit, all on generalized anxiety disorder. And when you give someone an SSRI at all, have them go into those programs, they don't even need a med. Mm-hmm. And so that would be huge, getting rid of those baseline issues. And if you can use non-pharm, that would be great. The other would be, you know, the meetings, the group meetings of persons who have the illnesses. You know, like I said, when you've had the illness, you're better adept at knowing when someone's BSing you. And that's why these AA meetings and AA meetings can be successful, because they have someone calling them out saying, oh, you're full of crud. You know, you just want to use, just say it. And they call each other out. And that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. So those kind of group scenarios are excellent. And just a talk in therapy of what has been your prompt in your life to do this, well, I got some PTSD or whatever, from a counseling perspective. Let's get rid of anything that's prompted someone to use a substance as a coping mechanism. And sometimes patients don't know why they're doing it. Mm-hmm. So those are all good things.
It sort of sounds like as a profession, we've been putting Band-Aids over these issues instead of really treating the root cause.
I would agree. Or even if it is low opiate stimulation and buprenorphine is satisfying that from that component, you can't discount the other parts of the illness, the behavioral stuff, the lifestyle, you know, where are they living? Well, you know, if my girlfriend is selling drugs out of my apartment, I probably should find another girlfriend, or at a minimum find another apartment, mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. So yeah, we'll give the guy all the buprenorphine he wants, but he's still going to use. I mean, it's you can't avoid it. So that those kind of things, you're right. Yeah.
All right. I feel like I don't have any pressing questions.
I'm trying to think of anything else.
Anything specific you want to mention?
Let's see. We talked about training. We talked about the overall thing. We talked about the community stuff and doing what Carl allows. Do we want to talk a little bit more about what Medicaid, how their perspective of it is?
Yeah,
or
I do actually
no?
want to get more of the Medicaid perspective.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Form question.
In terms of, I know you wrote, we did stalk you a little bit. We found that you wrote an article about prior auth for high-dose opioids for Medicare.
Oh, the one from Journal of Pain.
Yeah.
We're pretty proud of that work.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
Yeah.
Do you want to speak a bit about prior authorization for high-dose opioids in the Medicare population?
Yeah, so it was a program out of UMass Medical School, and I consult with them working on these projects with the Medicaid patients as our subjects. And the idea of saying, well, if we can help the docs lower the doses, that they could be doing on their own, but maybe there's just not a strategy within their office to do that, then perhaps we'd get less pills on the street. Mm-hmm. And so about 15 years ago, we started this process saying, well, our PA for a high dose of opiate probably is just a little bit too high compared to what the bell curves are for pain management or durations of treatment, those type of things. So we started chipping away over a decade ago. Then the idea that every couple of years we would chip away a little bit more, and we found that we've reduced the amount of opiates that were prescribed dramatically, at like 80% in some of the drug classes. So it was the idea that, are we helping the doc reduce the opiate prescriptions? Yes, that is happening. Less pills are being prescribed to the doctors that work with these Medicaid and Medicare patients. That's true. But the idea is that then do those patients go out and use another kind of opiate, or are they buying it off the street? We weren't able to detect that because we don't know what they're doing. We did feel comfortable that the idea that the newer person who is going to be an opiate user, develop an opiate use disorder, because their physician did not properly monitor how much opiate they're using. You know, instead of saying, well, you know, this is usually a 2-week type of pain syndrome post-surgery. Or, yeah, you hurt your back in a car accident, but in a month it should be improving, and therefore we're going to start chipping away your opiate. When that falls apart, we felt that those patients, by putting in our PA policy, would prompt the doctor to then have those conversations, and those patients might not develop into an opiate disorder. But the ones who already have it, they're likely to start using another opiate, either the heroin or some prescription drug that they just bought off the street. So it really was designed to say, we're going to remind the doctors what is probably safe prescribing practices with the PA, because that's what PA is all about. Mm-hmm. And the other is to say, these newer patients who are accidentally going to dump into opiate use disorder just through, you know, poor management, poor oversight, we're going to protect that from happening in the future, you know, for the next set of patients that come along.
Did you monitor pain management for these patients while you were conducting this study?
So, we measured the amount of prescriptions that were written. And part of the PA process is that they have to have a pain contract and a pain consult, a consult from what we have described as certain persons who are qualified to assess pain. Like an oncologist is someone who is, we consider, appropriate to assess pain. Pain management specialist. We said, yeah, you're good at it. So we do require that that happens. And it's interesting to see how many of these pain consults will say, I'd say anywhere between 20 and 30%. Will say, we probably shouldn't increase the opiate at all, or actually start decreasing the opiate. And once in a while, the doc will not do it. Mm-hmm. And so then we get into the game and say, well, then you're going to have to do a PA and justify why you're going against what a specialist would say for the management of this patient. You just got to justify it to us, because it could be legit, but sometimes it isn't, and we just got to help the doc help themselves a little mm-hmm. bit. And then they help the patient, kind of thing. So that's what we found, that we've been able to reduce the amount of opiates that are being prescribed in the Medicaid patients. And we haven't had any pushback to say, however, there have been more heroin deaths in these patients have done that. We actually looked at overdose-related events in general, and we found that they've gone down a little bit. So for sure, we didn't worsen anything, and that's a good sign.
What other work have you been doing with Medicare patients?
The newest one is this combination with the benzos and the opiates, mm-hmm. and that just came out. We've been working on it for about 4 years, because mm-hmm. it's a hard process mm-hmm. to make sure that we're not hurting any patients, that the docs can do something that's manageable within their office. And that's why I'm the consultant on the team, is because I see the practical side of it. I'm working in offices and saying, yeah, we could probably implement this. This will never happen, or this will happen, so let's make the implementation this way versus that way. And so we have just started it. I'll let you know how it goes. About a year's worth of education to the docs, just through mailings and faxes, to say, we're going to start doing this. Here's the rationale behind it. Three of the CE programs that I did were sponsored by Medicaid to prescribers. Anybody could go. But it was the idea to say, we want to talk about this because it is coming. Eventually, we want to get the docs at least aware that this is going to happen. And the intent is to say, please justify why they need to be on these two drug classes chronically, daily chronic use. So it's not, I'm on Xanax 1 milligram a month for 5 years. That's not what we're looking at. We're saying, I'm on Xanax 3 times a day for even 6 months. Why are you doing that when you never even started them on Zoloft or Lexapro or Prozac, that kind of thing? And so that's the newest thing that we're doing right now. But it just started. So we'll see. You know, it always is worse in the beginning, because some people weren't paying attention that this was going to happen.
Yeah.
And we're not stopping anyone from getting their meds because we know withdrawal syndrome with either drug classes is intense, and with benzos can be actually seizure-inducing or psychosis-inducing. Yeah, so we don't want to have that happen. So we have a very soft way of saying, well, we'll continue these meds, but in 3 months, we're going to ask to see if there's a change. Mm-hmm. And in another 3 months, that kind of thing. Really, to help the docs do things that they probably could be doing, either through lack of education or just time at the mm-hmm. office. And if they have to play Medicaid, doctors have said that, go, you know what, thanks for giving me an excuse to start chipping away at this person's whatever drug it is. Because he would, by blaming you, I'm off the hook and I can keep my relationship with my patient. Mm-hmm. I'm like, cool, do it. Sure. We want you to keep your relationship with the patient. So those kind of areas have been helpful.
It sounds like you've been collaborating more and more with other healthcare professionals. How would you say that the opioid epidemic has impacted sort of relationships within the healthcare field?
Yeah, I would say that it's gone up because, as you know, case management's gone up. Addiction counselors have gone up in terms of how many there are and how many jobs available in those areas. And the idea of saying, well, can I do this safely, I mean, from the prescriber perspective, and then I have someone who's going to see the patient in a week from now, and then saying, well, you know, I got to talk to this guy in a week. Let me just ask the counselor who's going to see him or the one who's running the meeting on Wednesday nights here in the clinic. And so I think that has boosted that communication process a lot.
Good. All right. I'm going to close this out then. Do you have anything else to say? Anything else you'd like to add?
No. You asked a lot of really insightful questions. So that was good.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Angelini, for taking the time to speak to us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Anytime.